This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking. Thank you for joining us. My name is Stephanie Wilder Taylor.
And I'm Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. As you know, Stephanie joined us recently in Your Right Mind, and this is our second show. What I didn't mention in the last show, and because it was so long to give all the credits that she's had, that she's been on Larry King Live, CNN, and Dr. Phil's show, etc. She's also been on a TV show that was on Nickelodeon Jr.
Yes, it was called Nick Mom.
Nick Mom.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in People's Magazine and US Weekly. So it'll take up the entire show by the time I finish giving her all the credit. But nevertheless, this is, it's a real pleasure to have you again.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I think these topics that we talk about on the show are so important, and it's great to get that information out there to people. And I'm very interested in especially today's topic. We are talking about alcohol and the teenage brain. Teenage drinking has always been a problem, but nowadays kids are experimenting with alcohol earlier than ever before. We all know that when teenagers drink, there's all sorts of negative consequences, right? From failing grades in school to drinking and driving and all kinds of risky behaviors. But there's serious developmental effects of drinking. The latest research suggests that alcohol causes more damage to the developing brains of teenagers than was previously thought.
Yes, and alcohol can alter brain development, potentially affecting both brain structure and function. This can cause cognitive or learning problems and make the brain more prone to alcohol dependence. We must heed that cliched warning that drinking literally kills brain cells. With us today to help unpack this information is Sovereign Health's Chief Clinical Officer, Dr. Anthony Mealy. He comes with 25 years plus of clinical expertise, but more interestingly, he will tell us about his doctoral thesis, which was on neuroplasticity, where we talk about how brain cells can regenerate themselves. And when I was in med school, we were taught that there were only two organs in the body that can regenerate themselves, the skin and the liver, and that was it. Now we know that to be false, because that we know that brain cells can regenerate themselves. And so and when you have a stroke, for example, we know that there are pathways in the brain that can be regenerated. But new research from King's College London a year or so ago has shown, albeit in animals and starting to be shown, I think, in human beings as well, that irrespective of age, we can start growing new neurons. It's not about just having alternate pathways if there's an assault on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So this is new information where we need to be cognizant of the fact that it is possible to grow brain cells irrespective of your age. And it is also the corollary to that is that you can kill the developing brain, and you can, you know, there's a trajectory of growth in terms of developing brain, and the teenage brain, the adolescent brain is vulnerable in terms of his trajectory. And I'm sure Dr. Mealy will talk more about that. And when there's an assault on that brain, whether it's via drugs or a physical assault, and let's talk about the substances, alcohol in this instance is what we're discussing, that's where the trajectory is disrupted. And so that's why it's very important for us to recognize the fact that we need to intervene, and if we intervene, we can reverse these issues.
Right, right. Well, speaking of intervening, we also have with us today Robin Reiser, She's a friend of mine. She's a writer. She's an actress. She's a mom. And she has a personal story about drinking as a teenager that we're going to get to. But let's say hi to Dr. Mealy.
Hi, how are you? Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Why exactly is alcohol consumption worse for teenagers than it is for adults?
Well, you know, as Dr. Sharma was indicating, it sets the a problem-solving pattern that is not necessarily efficacious in the long run. We know enough about the way the adolescent being responds to short-term, you know, rewards, and you know has a bit of a challenge on delaying immediate rewards. So you get, you know, you go down a pathway where you're seeking immediate, rewards and immediate gratification, which unfortunately is not the way the adult world behaves. So we're creating a pattern of response and interaction with the environment that is somewhat truncated and sets the pattern for a lifetime of poor decision-making based on how the brain is responding to different problems that the human encounters. So it really sets the individual up for a pretty bad problem-solving and coping pattern.
Right, right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. We're talking about drinking and the teenage brain. And we have a person who drank a lot as a teenager with us right now. Robin, tell us a little bit about...
Hi
Robin. Hi. Tell us about how you were drinking as a teenager and how that affected your life.
Well, I started drinking earlier than being a teenager. I mean, I started when I was a kid, just sipping wine at parties, etc. And
when you say a kid, how old are you talking?
My memories go back to when I was 5, and I was hiding under the Thanksgiving table and stealing people's glasses from above the table.
Well, what made you at 5 think that that would be a good idea?
Well, my parents were very relaxed about that, and they thought, you know, they drink wine, and so I asked for some, and they said, well, we'll mix some water in and give you a little cup of wine with water, and it was very diluted, and I'm sure, you know, that happens all over the place, and people don't react the way I did, but I loved it, and I couldn't get enough, and it made me feel great, and so... I didn't really think about it. I didn't think, well, that is something I want to get my life involved with. But I did like it. And then when I got a little older and kids around me started buying beer or stealing from their parents' liquor cabinets or whatever, I wanted to be a part of that, as well as the sort of mystique of a more dangerous lifestyle of a young teenager. I wanted to be a part of that as well. So I found myself drinking to the point of throwing up frequently very young. 13, I think, is when I really got into it.
Wow.
There's sometimes this notion that, you know, it's wine, it's not hard liquor.
Oh, right.
that, you know, it's somehow... You know, somehow okay that wine is fine.
Wine is fine. Yeah, and later in the show, we're going to get into a lot about parents and the different attitudes towards their kids drinking. But so what happened? Did it escalate very quickly?
Yeah, it escalated very quickly. I like to think of it as, you know, sometimes, like, if there's a plane crashing, it takes a while for that plane to go down. It sort of crashes slowly. But if a helicopter crashes, it just kind of drops to the ground really fast. And that was the way that I came to my bottom. And, you know, I quickly went from just drinking to involving other substances. And I don't know how much you want me to go into that, but...
Sure, whatever. Tell us everything.
You know, once I was going down that road... there was more and more things around me, and I wanted to try more. You know, it's always, usually it's like pot and then what other things people are doing around you. And I, even though I had learned to just say no, I also learn to say yes. And so I also was just trying different things. And I became, all the relief that it was caused, that the drinking and drugs were offering me was quickly replaced by a great deal of emotional distress, mental distress, and my life was really out of control. And my parents actually read my diary while I was away on an Outward Bound trip. And when I came back, they had an intervention that they sort of tricked me into going. And to give you just the picture of how young I was and where my life was, they told me I was going to an orthodontist appointment. And instead, they took me to this place, and they had with them copies of my diary. And so I couldn't lie. I had was a very good liar, and I couldn't lie. And it was very embarrassing. And but it was just them. They had their intervention, and they put me in the car, and they took me to a treatment facility.
Wow. You know what? We're going to take a break, but I can't wait to come back and hear more with Robin and more with Dr. Mealy. You are listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Want to get the latest information regarding mental illness, substance abuse, and more? Then get hooked on Hook Sober, a group of sobers who have been hooked on updating you with the latest trends regarding behavioral health and addiction. Want to check them out? Go to HookedSober.com. That's HookedSober.com. And get hooked, because recovery is possible in all cases.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We are talking about alcohol and the teenage brain, and we've been hearing from Robin Reiser, an actress, comedian, and mom, about her experience having an intervention at 16. And also with us on the phone is Dr. Anthony Mealy, the chief clinical officer at Sovereign Health. Dr. Mealy, is this typical of stories that you hear for kids coming in to Sovereign Health, or is her story more severe, or what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I was looking at the data between 2006 and 2017 on the most frequently described reasons for adolescents to begin or sustain drinking. And, you know, in Robin's own story, she hit upon several of them, including the whole risk-taking behavior, the desire to kind of self-stimulate, if you will. And, you know, Robin's own description of what we would call cross-addiction is very common. You know, they talk about, is alcohol a gateway drug, or is marijuana a gateway drug? I'm not even sure that's a relevant question, because a lot of the self-stimulating substances and even behaviors, such as, you know, perhaps overeating or gambling, they are experienced in the brain in a very similar feedback loop, in that they're providing a neurochemical reward in the brain, whether or not it's cocaine or alcohol or gambling. And then, Robin, it was experienced either a negative reaction, shame, guilt, maybe self-loathing. And then what do you need to do once you experience that? Well, you need to kind of get out of that. You need to medicate that. So the loop, you know, the cycle continues. So, you know, I was really struck by how accurate, Robin's self-description, resonates to what the literature is telling us, and as well as to what some of the adolescents we experience at in our adolescent program in San Diego, what they share is very, very similar.
You know, I'm really interested in how you can tell the difference between teenage drinking that is experimenting and teenage drinking that is, you know, signs of alcoholism. Because I know for myself, I drank just like Robin early on. I drank at 14 and regularly had blackouts. And, you know, when you get older, you hear that having blackouts, the memory loss
And I would have full hours and hours that I could, had no recollection of at all. And then later did, I mean, I am somebody who's in recovery now and had to quit drinking entirely. But, you know, you hear that that's rare, that that's a huge sign of alcoholism. But it seems like a lot of my friends had that same symptom, and maybe not all are alcoholics now. What do you say about that?
Well, you know, one of the questions I was going to ask Robin was what was the family system like, and kind of the environment that she was raised in? How did the family appreciate or you know define alcohol use? And was there any other individuals in the family who maybe, without naming names, who maybe had an alcohol or a substance abuse problem?
In my immediate family, my parents had a very normal relationship with alcohol. And they drank, you know, maybe they had a glass of wine with dinner or before bed, unwinding in the evening. There was nothing out of the ordinary or something to worry about there. And so their attitude was, I would say, very within the normal realm. But what wasn't talked about was both my grandfathers and one of my grandmothers all had exhibited alcoholic behavior. So my one grandmother had been a big gambler, and it's still not really talked about. But she was a very compulsive gambler. And then my grandfather on that same side also exhibited substance abuse type issues. And then my other grandfather on the other side also was known as a lively, fun guy at a party. And so, and because he would drink to the point of being blustery and sort of embarrassing, but everybody around him sort of couched that in, oh, he's such so much fun at a party. He's got so much personality. But I don't think that it was a healthy relationship with alcohol in his case.
Mm.
And so, you know, there wasn't any talking about, and I will say that as I went into adolescence and my parents knew about kids doing drugs, kids experimenting with smoking or kids experimenting with marijuana or whatever, and drinking, they saw that as so separate from my life. They sort of talked about it as though it wasn't anywhere near me. It wasn't happening anywhere near me. And they had no idea that it was happening just right in their house. You know what I mean? That it was so close. It always seemed to them, until they really discovered it, that it was happening far, far away in another land where teenagers are heathens.
Sure. You know, it's an interesting, issue. We are learning that the role of genetics plays probably about a 40 to 60% contribution to an addiction. And so we 40 to 60%. So we say 50%, and then we look at where does the other 50% come from, and that's when we start to look at the environment, the role of the environment. Everybody has the potential, right? Everybody has the potential to be an addict, to have an addiction. That's pretty much hardwired into the brain, only because to survive, we have to repeatedly seek out pleasurable activities. And that's the way the brain is organized. The dopamine, system says to us, if I eat, I'm going to enjoy that. It's going to produce a pleasure, and eating sustains me. Sexual activity produces a pleasure, and sexual activity sustains, the species. So the brain is organized to seek pleasure in a good way. The unfortunate piece of this is that drugs, alcohol to some degree, but drugs certainly repeat that same loop. It creates pleasure. Okay, so we're actively seeking pleasure, but the problem is repeatedly abusing drugs or alcohol as the pleasure source does rewire the brain. So even if you have a low genetic predisposition for an addiction, you can end up with an addiction if you repeatedly use drugs or alcohol to achieve your pleasure.
That's
you've
so
kind of replaced what most folks are using for pleasure, food, relationships, social, you know, niceties. You've replaced that with a drug or alcohol or gambling or something other than, you know, what society, you know, kind of conforms to.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about addiction and alcohol in the teenage brain, and we're hearing about some of the risk factors from Dr. Anthony Mealy, the Chief Clinical Officer at Sovereign Health. And what, besides the genetic component, can you tell us about any other risk factors that certain teenagers might have to develop alcohol addiction?
You know, I think that what parents, most parents have become aware of, there are certainly, when we start to see changes in behaviors, social withdrawal is a pretty significant, you know, risk factor. If a child starts to isolate, changes or reduces, social activities with friends, family attitudes toward alcohol, contributor to the subsequent alcohol abuse. Certainly, we have the genetic components, family stressors, we talk about, you know, individual experiences that a child might go through, traumas such as bullying, rejection, things like that, are definitely, contributing factors. I remember a high school teacher, and I taught in suburban, right outside New York City in North Jersey, and I remember the school district requiring all the seniors to do an essay pretty much on the evils of alcoholism or alcohol abuse. And I remember, saying to my students, okay, we have to do this essay. You know, let's talk about, let's brainstorm as a class. Why so much alcohol abuse? And right across from our classroom, outside the window was a huge billboard, just gigantic billboard, advertising, you know, one of the particular rum manufacturers. And I remember one of the kids saying, that's the answer. That billboard is staring right into our school. It's the marketing, you know, of alcohol should all do, because it's definitely a cultural phenomenon. And we see that in the research. We see that, you know, over 10 years from 2006 to 2017, targeted advertising, you know, that alcohol is kind of a gateway to adulthood, continues to show up as one of the risk factors enticing kids to drink.
Wow. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we're going to talk a lot more about this with Dr. Anthony Mealy and Robin Reiser. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We'll be right back.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or online at sovhealth.com.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about him. They cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind. We are talking about teenagers and drinking and when it's a problem. We have Dr. Anthony Mealy on the line with us. We're sitting here with Dr. Sharma, and we have Robin Reiser. Where are we with this? How do we know when a teenager needs intervention?
Robin?
Well, I didn't actually know that I needed intervention, and I think if it was left up to me, I would have just kept going the way that I was going. My parents had read my diary, and actually what they read in it that caused them to take action wasn't that I was drinking or the amount of what I was doing, or it was the amount of distress and pain that they read that caused them to really take notice. And so for me, it wasn't, hey, I'm just going to a party and having a good time. It was, you know, my life is out of control. I'm in situations that are horrible and painful, and I can't get out. I can't find my way out of it. I mean, I didn't say those exact words, but that was what they read in my own words. That's what they saw. And so they took action and had an intervention for me.
But when did you know that the intervention, when did it resonate with you? When were you... Did you stop feeling like, screw you, I can't believe you're doing this to me, you're going to ruin my life? And when did you feel like, thank God that somebody stepped in and helped me?
I did feel like immediately, like, screw you, you're ruining my life, you're horrible people, you're evil, you read my diary, how can I ever trust you again? That was my initial reaction. And luckily, they had been coached in, and there was an intervention therapist there who helped them to be prepared for my reaction. And so they didn't engage with me on that level. And they just went forward with their plan. And because I was 16, I had no choice but to either run away from home or go with their plan. And it was actually in the car on the way to the airport that I realized that I didn't, that the answer, that help had come, that I wasn't going to let my parents know this at that time. I wasn't willing to say, you're right, I have a problem. But in my own heart, I felt this is the answer. I don't have to keep living in this painful way. Something's going to happen now that's going to be different. And hopefully it'll remedy this pain that I'm in.
Dr. Mealy, the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse, the NIAAA, talk about five distinct aspects that are a problem for people that are young and those that drink versus those who don't drink. Firstly, impaired judgment and risky behavior. Secondly, that they injury from these risky behaviors. And then obviously getting into problems with law enforcement. And then the physical problems like liver damage, upsetting sex hormones and growth hormones. And we know we've already talked about the issue with brain development. and possibly development of muscles and bones. And the biggest risk of all, people who start drinking at a young age are much, much greater risk of becoming alcohol dependent. So given this, these multitude of issues, what might one expect in terms of treatment for this population?
Well, you know, I'm very struck by Robin's revelation that the content of her diary was replete with emotional distress. And, you know, I was at a conference recently where the psychiatrist, you know, told the audience, there's no such thing as a happy addict. And I think that that's what we see continuously as a constant. With the children that we serve, the adolescents that we serve in our San Diego program, the history is that they bring to us at a very young age, 14, 15, 13 years old, is one of a lot of emotional anguish, whether or not it's anxiety or depression or significant trauma, all of which is, you know, gives rise to a self-medicating type of behavior. And I think that what I see, and this is, you know, as a former high school teacher, all the way up through a practicing psychologist to an administrator, I think that our industry, behavioral health, has produced these entities called dual diagnosis treatment centers. And what I look for and what I would look for as a parent or as a teacher making a referral is I would look to make sure that a treatment center or a treatment protocol includes very strong mental health competence. I do think, as Robin has shared, that most of these addictive behaviors have their roots in some kind of an emotional, psychological distress, be it depression, be it anxiety, be it trauma. And the failure to be able to treat that effectively, I think, you know, sets up the treatment for ultimate failure. So that's, I think, very important to get treatment for that underlying emotional contribution to the addiction.
So if you, for example, if, you know, you're depressed and then you start drinking, so are you an addict, so to speak, or do you suffer now from substance use disorder, or have you got depression as a primary diagnosis? Because you could get admitted for a diagnosis of substance use disorder, according to the DSM, but your problem really is depression because you started drinking because you were depressed. And then, this is a vicious cycle because alcohol will make you more depressed.
Depressed, right.
And so are you depressed because you're drinking now, or you're drinking because you're depressed? So the issue arises also, giving another analogy, that you start drinking and if we sorted out just the drinking, for example, then we send somebody away and never treated the depression, the scenario that comes to mind is like treating a chest infection in a HIV patient. That you treated the superficial problem that is there and never really treated the cause. So,
you know what I think is interesting is that we've got about a 60 to 75% co-occurrence of a mental health / personality, we'll call it personality disorder, co-occurring with an addiction. And what we know from personality disorder studies, we know that depression, anxiety, personality styles, they become fairly obvious in early adolescence. Okay, so we know by the time a child is 12, 13, we know, is this kind of a depressive child, an anxious child? Is it a budding narcissist, let's say? So we know that the personality has already become apparent at an age that usually predates alcohol or substance abuse. by the time a child or an adolescent is kind of identified as abusing a drug or a substance or alcohol, it's usually in later in adolescence than his or her personality has emerged. So I do appreciate it. It's sometimes considered a chicken egg, but I think that the research would say to us the personality has emerged prior to the addiction. And when I'm looking at creating either interventions or, you know, training staff, I always, you know, say to them, we need to go back in time, take a good history of what this child's family situation was like, educational system was like, all their early childhood experiences, because that really, to me, the way I conceptualize this, that has pretty much contributed environmentally to some of the behaviors that the child has developed, which might include substance or alcohol use. So that's how I see it when I'm doing my trainings.
You know, we need to take a quick break, but I just want to say that if any of what we're talking about right now, if it makes you want to talk to somebody, if you're having any concerns about somebody who is in your house, you can call Sovereign Health right now at any time for no charge at 866-325-1801. That's 866-325-1801. And if you want to learn more about Sovereign Health, you can go to sovhealth.com. That's sovhealth.com. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We'll be right back.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297 or online at sovhealth.com.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about, and they cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind. My name is Stephanie Wilder-Taylor, and I'm here with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. And on the line right now, we have Anthony Mealy, who is the Chief Clinical Officer at Sovereign Health. And also with us is Robin Reiser, a writer, actress, comedian who discussed her drinking and her intervention at a young age of 16, which leads us to what is the environment that kids are in, that they're drinking in, that leads them to having a drinking problem? And how can we figure out what to do with them and where to send them and whether they need help.
Well, you know, I think that that's a great question. I think the environment is, you know, pretty much both the has contributed slash the cause, as well as it's the antidote or the cure. So the environment is critical. For some reason, the adolescent has experienced the environment, be it the family, the school setting, the neighborhood, whatever, as somehow creating or contributing to anguish, to distress, to emotional upset. I think we've discussed that a little bit earlier. So, you know, when I'm looking at treatment programs and when I'm working with my team to create interventions, you know, we look at the addictive behavior as both a systemic issue, the perhaps the family, the extended family, as well as the individual person's challenge to overcome. So I think that a treatment intervention needs to be both a family systems approach as well as a coping skills, a brain wellness approach for the individual. I think it's a combination of both types of interventions.
Well, let me ask you this. I have a feeling that a lot of parents out there are maybe scared or resistant to sending their kids to treatment because they feel like it somehow reflects poorly on them. They feel like they're going to get blamed, like, oh, you're going to look at me and say something's going on in that family. Can we reassure parents that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something even wrong with their parenting or wrong with their family, that some kids are just going to be addicts and we need to help them?
I really appreciate that question and that observation, because the last thing that any family, any loved one needs is to feel blamed, particularly when we're all motivated to help create recovery and hope and a future. So, absolutely. I think that we need to be about empowering the system. The system will need to change. There's no doubt about it. And that can be a good thing. It can be a good thing for certainly the individual with the addiction, as well as members of the system that don't have an addiction. So you're correct. We don't want to, you know, lay blame or guilt, on the family or the caregivers or the loved ones. They didn't create this, and they certainly didn't willingly or willfully contribute to this. We've got to be about creating a future and creating hope rather than casting blame.
Yeah, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmay Sharma, and we're talking about whether we need to intervene on some teenagers that are drinking and, trying to figure out the cause and the effect. And what can you tell us a little bit about what to look for in a place to find treatment for our kids, and you know, what is the right type of situation? What is happening there? What should we look for?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing we should be looking for are the outcomes. How how has the treatment facility fared vis-a-vis other treatment centers? Is it appropriately, is it accredited? In our industry, the Joint Commission tends to be the gold standard of accreditation. Does the treatment facility meet that standard? Look at their outcomes. Look at how is the treatment facility done as far as depression at admission versus depression at discharge, anxiety at admission, anxiety at discharge. What's the family therapy program like? So I think, you need to really, for me, because our industry is a relatively new part of medicine, I think it's very important to look at actual outcomes that are available. And as I say, I think the Joint Commission is a good place to start.
Robin, you had a very successful treatment. I mean, look at you. How many years have you been sober now?
26 years.
So something went very right
one day at a time
in the treatment you got.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about, like, what was it that changed for you that you went from being that out of control teenager to the person that you are now?
To the, an upstanding citizen.
A law-abiding mama.
Well, one, I will say one thing is that it's not like just in that 28 days that was that something happened and that's kept me from, that's what's kept me sober for the last decade and a half. That is not the way recovery works. It works, you know, over time. So I've had an enormous amount of support throughout my life since. And so I just want to say that really clearly, that there's no immediate thing. Then suddenly you switch that switch off and now I don't have that problem anymore. But when I was there, I was the way that treatment facility helped me was that they presented me with all the things that were happening in my life as a reality. Like, look at this situation, look at this situation, look at this situation, and then led me to see how those things were happening as a result of my drinking, as a result of my using drugs, and it put me in a state of not wanting to return to that life, of saying, I have a choice. You know, it's so simple. I mean, there's so many complicated problems to have in the world. And this one is a simple one of like, yes or no. Yes, I will drink and incur these problems again, or I will not. And I will hopefully not have these problems again. And so that was presented to me and I heard it. And it opened my eyes to it, and it caused me to not want to return to that life. And that was the big, I would say, if there was one moment, that was the big moment. That was the big thing that they taught me. I can't speak to their administration and their philosophies and what else. I don't know any other program except that program, so I can't contrast and compare them. But I can tell you what I was taught there.
But also it shows, you know, often people ask whether interventions work, and at least in your case, intervention did work.
Yes, in my case, intervention worked. And I know lots of people where intervention has worked. I think that the one key, though, is that sometimes an intervention happens and doesn't work because maybe it's too soon. Maybe the person isn't in enough pain. And unfortunately, with most addictions, you have to be in enough pain to want to change. It doesn't happen because you think, yeah, I might have a problem with that. It happens because it hurts too much to stay where you are.
Yeah, I and again, this is I just want to spend 30 seconds on this because people are sometimes skeptical. Oh, it's an intervention, shouldn't work. And I've just got two personal experiences of this, and both done by Ken Seeley, and he did this for A&E intervention for the show. One for a very, very difficult lady, I remember, that she ran out of two different aircrafts after checking in.
Wow.
And boarding the aircraft, she ran out of both aircraft, and I think it was one of his most difficult interventions, and had gone to Chandler, the facility that we have for women with trauma. And 2 years later, she's still doing very well, and we're very, very proud. And so that was an intervention that worked. And another in San Clemente, and I'm not very involved on the clinical side of it, but when and Ken Seeley had mentioned this to me personally as to how it worked. And so it's nice to see things working. And that there are good outcomes of it. And then from Dr. Mealy, we can look at how to search for good. There are lots of good treatment centers, but also there are lots of not so good treatment centers, and people need to be discerning.
Absolutely. This has been very eye-opening. Is there anything that you can tell us, Dr. Mealy, before we go? Anything to look for in our kids? I mean, I know for me, I, you know, am a person who doesn't drink at all. I have a husband who drinks normally. Knowing that there's addiction in our family, I want to keep an eye out on my kids. I have 9-year-old twins and a 12-year-old who's, you know, and I drank at 14. And that's a scary thought, I think, for a lot of parents, knowing that we drank as teenagers. Is there any parting words you can say to how we can spot it?
Well, you know, I think, you know, you're hitting the nail on the head, just being aware of your own family history and susceptibility from the genetic perspective is really important. I mean, some families have high blood pressure, some families have, you know, diabetes, and, you know, and some families will have susceptibility to substance abuse. What I would look at is changes from, you know, the norm. So if your child has always played, you know, sports and then all of a sudden just starts to isolate and withdraw, and you know, if he doesn't replace sports with another, say, social activity. So I look for, you know, as a psychologist, we're always about looking for change, you know, unexplained changes, different behaviors. Certainly, you know, you look at change in clothing, change in a social network. Depending upon your family rules, if you're monitoring social media, which personally I think parents should monitor social media.
Or if you're old school, you know, a diary.
Well, you know, I come from a very traditional old school background. Privacy didn't exist. I do think, you know, we have to keep our you know, our eyes very close to these kids. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for all your valuable insight, Dr. Anthony Mealy. And thank you, Robin, for coming and sharing your story. And thank you, Dr. Sharma, for putting on this great show. You have been listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We will see you next Sunday at 5 p.m.
Bye-bye.
Show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.